Yeah, in the Pali Canon, we hear the Buddha say, it is through not knowing, not understanding, not penetrating this truth about the way things are, that this generation has become tangled up like a knotted ball of string, that it is covered with blight like a diseased crop, that it is strangled like plants smothered by weeds, that it cannot escape from the path of woe, that it is trapped in endless cycles of sorrow. So the Buddha tells us that it's through not knowing the way things are that all this sorrow and waste comes about. In other words, it's through lack of wisdom. There's not enough wisdom in the world. It's through not knowing the truth about the way things are. When we humans live our lives based on wrong ideas about the way things are, we create all sorts of destruction, unhappiness, and sorrow for ourselves, for everyone around us, and for those who come after us. That is what lack of wisdom in the world does. That was true at the time of the Buddha, and it's just as true today. We could paraphrase the Buddha for our own time by saying that it's through not knowing, not penetrating, not living according to the way things are, that this generation creates a world with war and poverty and environmental crises, that we create societies with warped values that make their citizens unhappy, that we create towns and cities that are not real communities but just piles of individuals, alienated individuals, living side by side and competing with one another. It's through not knowing the way things are that so many individuals live lives that are happy, unhappy and unfulfilled. Lack of wisdom in the world creates immense destruction and unhappiness. That was true in the Buddha's generation, it's true of our generation, and it's been true of every generation in between. Lack of wisdom in the world has got us into this mess, and just a little bit of wisdom might help to get us out of it. Could go a long way to getting us untangled. Wisdom is the thing that is needed to make the world a better place, especially if we include under the heading of wisdom all the things that flow out of it, which I'll talk about later. And wisdom here doesn't have to mean some sort of exalted, transcendental wisdom beyond words and concepts. It just means us human beings not living and not running our societies according to ideas and concepts that are manifestly silly, daft, upside down, as the Buddha called them. Wisdom could just mean have some ideas and concepts about the way things are that are at least a close enough approximation to reality to be a reliable, rough guide to the way we should act and live. So the ideas and concepts about the world that we use to guide our actions are a bit like a map. And okay, the map can never convey the exalted, wordless reality, but it can be a guide. If our map's faulty, if we guide our actions by concepts that don't reflect the way things are, then when we use that map, we get to somewhere, we'll find we get to somewhere else, somewhere we didn't want to go. So I live in Sheffield, as you've heard from the Lokadara, on the edge of the Peak District National Park. And if you set off in some directions from Sheffield, you can find yourself in paradisical countryside. If you set off in other directions, you can find yourself in a grim post-industrial wasteland. If you set off from Sheffield using a faulty map that doesn't reflect the way the things are on the ground, you might set off for the Derwent Valley or Lathkildale, but you might end up in Grimethorpe. There really is a place called Grimethorpe. You might end up in Grimethorpe scratching your head and wondering what went wrong. And that's what we human beings have been doing since the time of the Buddha and before. We've been setting off for paradise, but because we have a faulty map through not knowing, not understanding, not penetrating this truth about the way things are, we keep ending up in Grimethorpe, scratching our heads. At this present moment in history, one of the most popular maps that tells us the way to happiness and fulfilment says that to have as much stuff as possible, or as much fashionable new stuff as possible, to have as much entertainment and distraction as possible, and to focus on getting our own wants satisfied in competition with others is the way to happiness and fulfillment. And following that map is a guaranteed grade A one of ending up deeply, deeply unhappy, for reasons that I'll go into more as we go on with this talk. So we keep ending up in the wrong place, and it's not for want of effort and energy that we haven't created a really wonderful world for ourselves, a pure land. It's entirely because that energy has been wrongly directed. We've been using the wrong map. So as I've said, I live in Sheffield, and Sheffield is a city surrounded by hills. And I have this really strong memory of sitting on a hill overlooking the city on a beautifully clear summer's day, completely still summer's day, not a breath of breeze. So the sound carried through the still air, and being amazed to hear that this city spread out down below me gave off a roar. I was miles away and the best part of 1,000 feet above the city. But even from there, the city literally roared. It growled. There was so much activity going on down there. People travelling from place to place, people working, people making things, people playing and entertaining themselves, people going about their daily routines. So much energy being expended that it created a roar that you could hear for miles. And I remember thinking that if a Martian or some other terrestrial had been standing where I was, listening to that roar, how impressed they would have been with the sheer energy of these earthlings, whose activity could create this roar, and how they would have been convinced that in no time all these amazingly energetic beings would surely create something wonderful. They'd surely create a pure land, a paradise on earth, with all that effort and energy they were putting in. And I remember also thinking how surprised those extraterrestrials would have been when they actually got down in the city and saw what was all that energy was actually being used. So I think Sheffield's a great city. I'm a big fan of Sheffield, but it's no pure land. And as in most any city, most of that roar is created by restless, driven activity that doesn't serve very much purpose, and that even makes people more unhappy. That roar that I heard was the sound of 500,000 people running furiously on treadmills, all trying to catch a carrot that cannot be caught. Okay. That's a bit of an exaggeration. It's not quite true that all the activity that was going on there was absolutely to no purpose. There was some good things going on. But give me a bit of poetic license here, okay? As an image, there's a certain truth in that. So I've been making the point that a lot of the world's problems, the problems that humanity creates for itself, which are most of our problems, since we've sort of conquered the main diseases, etc., and we know how to grow plenty of food, most of our problems arise because there is not enough wisdom in the world. We make a mess of things because we don't act according to the way things are. We could stop making such a mess of things if we started acting more in accordance with the way things are. And the best description of the way things are that I've come across, and the best description of the way of for acting according to the way things are that I've come across, is the Dharma. And so I'd maintain the very best way we can contribute to making the world a better place is to make the Dharma more widely known and to create communities of people who live more in accordance with the Dharma. And that's why I choose to work in a Buddhist centre. So even as a teenager, I wanted to do something really worthwhile. I had this real urge. I wanted to do something worthwhile, something really valuable that I could really put myself into without reservations, something that would make the world a better place. But that's not so easy to find. So a long time ago, I gave up on politics, as most of us have. I mean, if everybody in the political parties is acting on greed, hatred, and delusion, it almost doesn't matter what their policies are. You know, it's not going to work. So sometimes I've just given up on doing anything worthwhile and just focus on getting some money and having plenty of pleasure. And then I felt really empty and unfulfilled. And then sometimes I've tried to do something more worthwhile, like I've tried to raise money for the environmental movement, and I worked for a while in an NGO working in West Africa. But all the people I was working with seemed to have a faulty map. I seemed to just be putting a plaster on a wooden leg. The real problem is deeper and more pervasive. The real problem is the lack of wisdom in the world. The fact that people don't live according to the way things are. And working in a Buddhist centre is just the very best way I've found of making the world a better place, bringing more wisdom into the world. And in the course of this talk, I hope to persuade you that putting yourself wholeheartedly behind the project of your local Buddhist centre may well be probably the best way that you can make the world a better place as well. And the best way to make yourself a bigger person in the process. So at that point, you're probably thinking, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But how can I bring more wisdom into the world through my local Buddhist centre? I'm not going to teach the Dharma. He'll probably say, well, you could give us some money. you could clean the toilets. Thanks. Well, you don't have to teach the Dharma directly. You could give money, and somebody does have to clean the toilets. That and other ways you can help out can be really doing the universe a favour. But putting yourself wholeheartedly behind the project of your local Buddhist centre also has a much wider meaning. The bricks and mortar of our Buddhist centres aren't what's important. What's important are the communities we create around these centres. I don't mean physical communities, bricks and mortar where people live together. Buddhist centres are sort of focuses, they're foci, where order members come together to gather a community of people around them, to gather a community of people who live by the Dharma. And by gathering such a community, Buddhist centres become, as Alokadhara said, they become oases. They become oases in a desert of unwisdom. So when I say put yourself wholeheartedly behind the project of your local Buddhist centre, I mean wholeheartedly joining in creating spiritual community, creating Sangha, making creating Sangha part of your practice. That's the way we're going to change the world, and that's also the way we get furthest. So I'll say more about that as we go on. So I've said that if we don't act according to the way things are, we create all sorts of problems, whereas when we start acting in accordance with the way things are, we can start to solve them, we can start to become part of the solution. But what do I mean? What do I mean by the way things are, the truth about the way things are? What does the Dharma tell us about the way things are? We heard some of that from Alokadhara yesterday. I'm going to take a slightly different slant on it. One of the Buddha's most fundamental teachings about the way things are is called the three marks. The three characteristics of conditioned things. So he taught that all conditioned things, meaning everything, have three marks or three characteristics. And these three characteristics of all things are that they are impermanent, they're transient, that they lack any fixed self-nature, and that they cannot bring ultimate happiness. So we usually use the Sanskrit terms for these. We call them the three lakshanas, the three marks. And we talk about the marks of anicca, impermanence, anatman, non-selfhood, and dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness. So looking at the first of those first, well, we heard about that from Alokadhara yesterday very, very eloquently. Anicca, or impermanence. We all know that things are impermanent, even if we don't act that way. We don't want to know that, so we choose to ignore it, but we all know. We all know that everything in the world, including ourselves, comes into existence and passes out of existence. We know that everything is constantly changing. Nothing stays the same. That's true at every level. Our thoughts and our feelings just come and go. The weather and the seasons continually change. So that every day we look out of our window, the world looks different. Our possessions wear out and break. Our bodies are constantly changing. I was looking at a picture of myself from the 80s in the main house, so I couldn't even recognise myself in it. Our cells are constantly growing and dying. I'm told that in 7 years there is not a single molecule in our body which was there 7 years ago. We're just completely different. We're changed. We're a process, as Alokadara said yesterday. We're a process of change, not a fixed thing. And so is everything else, even the things that look permanent. Even the landscape features. I mean, there are limestone hills, chalk hills, which were once... They're the accumulations of the skeletons of beings that lived in tropical oceans millions of years ago. They've been buried under the ground so deep, under such pressure, they've been turned into rock. They've then been raised up into mighty mountain ranges. They've then been eroded down and eroded by glaciers. And then we get chalk hills or limestone hills. That's going on all the time. Even the continents are moving around, we're told. Unchanging shape. Everything is changing. So the world we see around us and everything in it is a process of change. It's a flux. And we usually see that as something negative because we focus on the fact that things we like vanish, especially ourselves, which is a profoundly unwelcome message. But actually, each of the Lakshanas has a really positive side. The positive side of impermanence is transformation and growth. New things are always coming into existence. Things evolve, they get more complex, new beauty arises. In fact, if it weren't for impermanence, life would be intolerable. You would have to listen to me giving this talk forever. Life would be stagnation. Fixity. Impermanence, change, well, it's what makes life interesting, but it's also what opens up new possibilities. Impermanence means we can change, other people can change, society can change. It opens up a world of infinite possibility in which there is no limit to what we could become and to the world we could create among ourselves. So that's impermanence. Then the second of the marks of all things, anatman, or lack of self nature, tells us that it's not just that everything changes. There are no things. There's only change. There are no things, not if by thing we mean something that has some sort of unchanging separate existence, independent of everything around it. There are no things, there's only change. Not just that everything changes, there's only change. Everything is a process, a flux, and everything is part of that. Everything is constantly interacting with everything else around it. Everything is affected by everything else around it. Everything is constantly affecting everything else around it. Everything relies on just about an infinite number of conditions for its existence. We divide this process, this flux, this process of change and interaction up into separate parts and give them names because, well, we have to for practical purposes. But where we put the boundary between different things, the things we call particular names, is pretty arbitrary. We can't really separate anything from its surroundings. So if we look at ourselves... we're a process. We're a process that's made up of smaller processes, like our heart and our lungs and our kidneys and our cells. And they all get on with being themselves and doing their thing independently of us, thank heavens. God, it would be terrible, wouldn't it, if we had to sort of keep thinking, come on, kidneys, come on. Come on, lungs. Come on, heart, keep going. They've all got a certain entity themselves. They've got a certain real existence, a real separate real existence themselves, and they just get on with doing it. And we depend on them. And then we're part of bigger systems. We're part of the ecosystem of our planet. We completely depend on that. We're constantly... Our food depends on the sun, the oceans, the circulation of the atmosphere, the soil. the air we breathe, the water we drink, we are completely separate. If completely dependent on that. If any of that goes, we go. And then we're also part of society, which has made us who we are and continually affects us. All the people around us continually affect us. We continually affect all the people around us. And we rely for our survival on the people who produce the things we need and the services we provide. And we wouldn't survive a week on our own. So we're made up of smaller systems we depend on that have got a certain entity themselves. And we're part of bigger systems we depend on that have got a certain sort of entity themselves. And when we draw a boundary around this body and pretend it's something independent and say me, we're making quite an arbitrary distinction. We're drawing quite arbitrary boundaries. We exist a bit like, the way we exist is not like separate things. It's a bit like eddies in a flowing river. If you look at a flowing river, it's got eddies in it. An eddy's got a certain identity. Some are bigger than others, some are smaller than others, some have got a particular shape for a while, some are faster than others. But they're constantly changing. They've got a certain continuity, but they're constantly changing, constantly interacting with all the other eddies and currents around them, and ultimately they're not separate from the water and the river. And that's what the idea of anatman, or non-self nature, is telling us. We and everything around us, we exist in a certain way, but not in the way we're used to thinking. We don't exist as separate, independent, in a separate independent way. We exist in a way that's interrelated with everything around us. And we depend on everything around us for our existence. So the world doesn't consist of a collection of independent things and selves. It consists of processes and relationships, all infinitely interrelated with each other. So this mark of anatman is sometimes taken to mean that we don't have a self, which can sound a bit negative and scary. But we do have a self. Just not the sort of self we thought we had. We have a self that's got a certain sort of shape at the moment, it's got certain qualities, but it's constantly changing. It's full of potential, and it's infinitely intimately interrelated to others and the world around us. Anatman is in fact a highly positive idea. It offers us a much more positive vision of who we are. So, in which we're not just separate, lonely beings in a hostile world, but in which we're beings full of potential, deeply related to other beings in the world around us, part of something much bigger than ourselves, part of something wonderful and mysterious. So that's the second of the three marks, anatman. The third mark of conditioned things is that they can't give us ultimate satisfaction, dukkha, which Alokadhara talked about yesterday. This is a bit different from the other two. So impermanence and lack of fixed self-nature are characteristics of the very nature of things. But dukkha, unsatisfactory, is more about the way we relate to things. The mark of unsatisfactoriness is not saying that there's something wrong or inherently satisfactory with a flower or a sunset or even a car or a mobile phone or a holiday. It's not saying there's anything wrong with that. What it is saying is if we look to those outer things, sensory pleasures, etc., for our fulfillment, we're bound to be disappointed and unsatisfied. External things, sensory pleasures, can't give us real permanent satisfaction. For a start, they're all impermanent. We get bored with our possessions, they get old, we get that new car, and then 2 weeks later, well, it's just a car. They break. Sensory pleasures are over in an instant. They're just gone, leaving us wanting more. We get just the right job. Just, if we're lucky enough, just the right job, just the right partner, just the right house, just the right everything, and then it changes. And anyway, even if we could get all the possessions and pleasures and everything else that we wanted, that we hanker for, and if by some miracle we could stop that situation changing, we'd still be unhappy. we get bored. Ultimately, it would seem really meaningless. Because ultimately, we're spiritual beings. And the only way we'll experience any real lasting satisfaction is to move towards making our spiritual potential a reality. Becoming the sort of person we have it in us to be. So if we make our happiness dependent on outer circumstances, we'll be constantly frustrated and unhappy. We need to pursue a form of happiness that doesn't depend on outer conditions. We need to seek a happiness that doesn't come, that comes from who we are, not from what we own or consume. But as we heard yesterday, the positive side of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, is there is a source of lasting satisfaction which can be found by following the Noble Eightfold Path, as Alokadhara told us yesterday, following a path of spiritual growth. When we start to become more the person we could be, we get out of our cycles of constant desire for things that can never satisfy, for things to be different, and we start to experience fulfillment. We start to experience real happiness that comes from higher mental states. So I like the three Lakshanas as a summary, a really pithy summary of the way things are, the truth about the way things are. And the last two marks that I talked about, the last two Lakshanas, non-self and dukkha, these two characteristics of the way things are the two great wings of the Dharma that come out and express themselves in just about every Dharma practice. So firstly, dukkha. Outer things and passing pleasures can't give real lasting happiness. So we need to learn to live more simply. We need to learn to look for our happiness in the things that really work: positive mental states, friendship, community, the beauty of the world, the simple pleasures of being alive. And secondly, anatman, or fixed self-nature. We don't exist as isolated individuals. We're inextricably interrelated to other things and the world around us. We're part of other beings and the world around us. So to live in accord with the way things are, we need to live in a way that expresses that relatedness. Selfishness is self-defeating. It isn't in accord with the way things are, and it will make us deeply unhappy in the end. So we could call these two great wings of the Dharma the principle of simplicity, dukkha, and the principle of relatedness. The principle that we need to get our happiness from having fewer wants, not trying to satisfy a plethora of wants, simplicity. And relatedness, that we need to cultivate our connection, our relatedness to others and the world, not separate ourselves. And, I mean, these, as I said, these two great principles of simplicity and relatedness, they come across in just about all the Dharma, just about all the Dharma teachings. So, for example, they're expressed in the five precepts. The third precept, for example, advises us to cultivate stillness, simplicity, and contentment, rather than cultivating craving and desire for things that can't satisfy. It's a direct expression of the principle of simplicity. It comes straight from the fact of dukkha. It's telling us how to live according to the way things are. Expressing the principle of simplicity. And then if we look at the first, the second and the fourth precept, for example, they advise us to live in a way that takes account of our relatedness to other beings. So to act in a way that's in accord with the fact of non-selfhood. So if we behave in ways that aren't in accord with relatedness, if we behave in ways that cut ourselves off from others, we make ourselves deeply unhappy. And we create all sorts of suffering and problems. If we ignore the first precept and we harm others or we engage in cruelty, we cut ourselves off from others. If we ignore the second precept and steal from others or exploit others in various ways, we cut ourselves off from others. If we ignore the fourth precept and lie to others, we cut ourselves off from others. And if we do all of those things, if we cut ourselves off from others, we make ourselves unhappy. We shut ourselves up in a more and more in a sort of small, cramped, smelly prison of our illusory self. But in contrast, if we behave in ways that are in keeping with relatedness, when we behave in ways that strengthen our links to others, connect us to others, express our relatedness, we create positive outcomes for ourselves and the world. When we take the advice of the first, the second, and the fourth precept, we behave with kindness, generosity, honesty, we strengthen our connection to other beings, to other people, and we become more expansive beings, bigger beings, more fulfilled beings, happier beings. We get rid of some of the bars of our prison. And because we aren't isolated individuals, because we exist as part of this web of relatedness, conditionality, the effects of our skillful actions don't stop with them. They spread outwards. They spread ever outwards. If we're generous to somebody, they will tend to be more generous. Generosity promotes generosity. That will spread outwards like ripples in a lake. Every skillful action has got the potential to go on forever, spreading out like ripples. It makes the whole world a better place. Of course, unfortunately, the same is also true for unskillful actions. How do we feel if somebody's really stingy? Well, why should I be generous? If we act stingily to somebody, they're more likely to be stingy with others, and so on. We make the world a stingier place, or a more cruel place, or a more dishonest place with every action. So that's four of the precepts. The fifth precept, about cultivating mindfulness or awareness, expresses both the principles, both the principle of simplicity and the principle of relatedness. So awareness, speaking first about relatedness, awareness or mindfulness is the direct way we connect ourselves to others and the world around us. When we're aware of somebody else, paying full attention to them, drinking them in, we're truly connected to them. If we're not aware of them, well, we're separate. And then when we pay attention to a tree or a sunset or a work of art or a piece of music, we're connected. We're truly connected. Awareness is the direct way we connect ourselves more fully to others and the world around us. It's the direct way we express the principle of relatedness. And it's also the key to going beyond craving for things that don't satisfy, for living according to the principle of simplicity. When we really pay attention, with a mind that's deeply aware, that's settled down enough to be really aware, we can begin to appreciate the real joys of life. Such as the beauty of the natural world, the delights of friendship, the simple pleasures of everyday life. We can only appreciate them when we're aware. When we're just skimming the surface of things, they don't work. We've got to have more gross pleasures. We've got to crave. But if we're really aware, we can appreciate the simple things, the real things. We can begin to find the peace of mind that allows us to experience higher mental states and to uncover our own inner richness. And then we find that we don't always need to be hankering after something else. We have real pleasure in our lives. We're freed from the constant desire for the next thing. We can get off the treadmill of always wanting, stop chasing the carrot that can't be caught. So the five precepts are a map. They're a guide of how to live more in accordance with the marks of dukkha and non-selfhood, more in accordance with the way things are, the principles of simplicity and relatedness. So these Dharma teachings, which we might think are just very simple and nothing to do with the higher wisdom teachings, are in fact the way we bring wisdom into the world. They are a map that's a lot more accurate than the one that tells us to satisfy our desires and focus on our own benefit to the exclusion of others. With that map, we end up in Grimethorpe. With the more accurate map of the precepts, we at least go roughly in the right direction. So the five precepts are wisdom in the world. And because of this, they transform people's lives for the better. I know this. I'm not just theorizing. I know this. For the past decade or more, I've been teaching introductory class after introductory class at our Buddhist centre. And I've been just amazed and inspired by the effects that simple Dharma teachings like the precepts have on people, even over quite a short period of a few weeks or months. People change visibly. They brighten up. They open up. They change their lives. They become happier, more fulfilled people. They say things like, why don't they teach this stuff in schools? This is the handbook for being a human being. Personally, I just find it a real privilege to be able to teach introductory Dharma classes at a Buddhist centre. I think it would be a real privilege. I'd be really privileged to think that I'd made a real positive difference to one person in my lifetime. I would find that quite a privilege. I'd be very happy to know that. And without in any way being arrogant, I know that by teaching the simple Dharma, I've made a real positive difference to not just one person, but to a lot of people. And that's not arrogant. I say that's not arrogant because I know it's not me, it's the Dharma that's done it. But I find it a real privilege. That would be true of anyone who teaches the Dharma. It's a real privilege. What a privilege it is. And I'm just very grateful to be able to be part of it. In the Pali Canon, the mythic leader of the divine beings appears to the Buddha and tells him, beings are perishing for want of the Dharma. And that's just still the plain truth. Beings are perishing for want of wisdom in the world, a map to guide their lives in a decent direction. And the work of Buddhist centres is the way we can bring more wisdom into the world. Buddhist centres save the lives of beings who are perishing for want of the Dharma, metaphorically, and sometimes quite literally, actually. So Buddhist centres are gateways through which wisdom flows into the world, which is what it desperately needs. But if we just teach the Dharma at our Buddhist centres, that's not going to be anything like enough. If we just give people some teachings and practices to take away, as though we were a sort of adult education institute, that just isn't going to help folk much at all. And to see the reason for that, we don't have to look any further than the fact of Anatman, the principle of relatedness. We can't really be separated from our environment. We're all deeply affected by the people around us and the conditions in which we live. No man is an island. And nobody is going to get far with practicing the Dharma without a supportive environment, without a Sangha. The pressures and influences on people from the world around us is just too great. So if we want to bring more wisdom in the world, and if we want to live in a wiser way ourselves, the very way we do this has to be in accord with the fact that we don't exist as isolated individuals. It has to express that. We exist as part of a web of relationships. We exist in an interrelated way. We can't be separated from our environment and our conditions. So even if we just want to change ourselves, and certainly if we want to change the world, we need to think bigger than just me. To get anywhere in the spiritual life, we need to be part of a Sangha, part of a supportive environment. And we can't just rely on others to create that Sangha. We aren't really part of a Sangha unless we're actively engaged in creating it. Sangha is a verb. It's something that we create. It's something we become part of by participating in. And participating in it means helping to bring it into existence and helping it to grow. And for this reason, our spiritual practice needs to be not just about me. It needs to be about us. We need to think not just about me becoming more enlightened, but about us becoming more enlightened. We need to play our part in building Sangha, in creating a spiritual community, in which people bring out the best in each other. This is just as important as our own individual practice. In fact, you could argue that it's even more important than our own individual practice, because without a supportive Sangha, none of us is going to get anywhere. So we need to see when somebody else makes progress, that's also our progress. And the more any of us make progress, the easier it will be for all of us. An analogy for this, I think, is building a fire. We wanted a bonfire after our puja last night. There just wasn't enough dry wood. Okay? If you're going to build a fire, say you've got a few pieces of wood. Some of them are smouldering. Some of them got a bit. Some of them are a bit warm, some are dry. Some of them are distinctly damp. Some of them are wet. Okay? Now, if you leave all those bits of wood lying around separate from each other, they'll all go out. If you take the ones that are smouldering and you pile them together, they might start to flame a little bit. And they might start to dry some of the ones around them. And then you pile some more around, you might start to get flames. Eventually you get dry wood, you get a blaze, a transformative blaze, by putting the pieces of wood together. And I believe we get a blaze that transforms all the wood it touches. And I believe that's how the spiritual life works, actually. And that's how we need to see it if we want to get anywhere. Buddhist centres aren't bricks and mortar. They're foci where order members come together in order to gather a community of people around them. A few bits of wood that are maybe glowing a bit get together, pile themselves together, and maybe you get a bit of flame. And then others come in and get dried out and pile themselves on, and then you get a bit more of a flame. And start to blaze, and the more people join in, the bigger the flame, the bigger the blaze, the hotter it gets. It's a chain reaction until all the bits of wood become a bright, blazing bonfire of positive transformation. So as Sangharakshita says, the bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, is much more likely to arise in a spiritual community of people practicing and working together for something bigger than themselves than it is in an isolated individual. So changing the analogy from fires to oases, the communities we create around Buddhist centres can be oases, islands of sanity in a desert of unwisdom. And if these islands, if these oases grow, we start to cultivate the desert around them, start to irrigate the desert, well, we can start to have an impact on society, the society around us. We can start to have a real influence. And I believe that's the way we're going to change the world, not by imposing grand political schemes from above, but by creating communities of people who live more in accordance with the way things are and can start to change the world from the bottom up, start irrigating the desert. Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of the oppressed Dalits in India, said something like that. When he delivered he wrote the Indian Constitution after independence. When he delivered the Constitution to Congress, he warned Congress. He said, well, I've tried to get the best Constitution I can, but that's not going to solve our problems. If in society people are acting according to greed, hatred, and delusion, we will have a terrible society. If in society people are acting according to wisdom, love and simplicity, we will have a great society. Don't expect the Constitution to do it. We've seen that. We've had great, sound like great political systems. What should communism have created? Well, what happened? People were still behaving according to greed, hatred and delusion. So we need to do it from the bottom up. We need to change ourselves. We need to irrigate the desert. If people act unwisely, we get a mess. A knotted ball of string. If people act wisely, we can start to untangle ourselves. And Buddhist centres are the way we get more wisdom into the world. The way that you and I, especially, can have an opportunity to bring more wisdom into the world. So it might not be obvious when you go there, but our sort of insignificant little Buddhist centres can be epicentres from which a new society can grow, from which we can irrigate the desert. Because they're gateways through which more wisdom can flow into the world. If we just see them as bricks and mortar and a few motley individuals running a sort of adult education centre in Buddhist studies or a sort of very minor mental health charity, it ain't going to happen. It ain't going to happen. But if we can engage our imagination with a mythic vision of what Buddhist centres could be, well, who knows what will happen. It might happen. We could make it happen. The oases we create could spread. We could irrigate the desert around us. And who knows? Who knows what we might do? Okay. The idea that we can really make a real difference to the society around us when it's so big and we're so small, it might seem hopelessly utopian. But hey, what else are we going to do? Even if we can't turn society into a pure land, well, why wouldn't we want to create mini pure lands? Human beings are perishing for want of the Dharma. And in our society, they're also perishing for want of a positive community to be part of, actually. Because of the fact of anatman, the fact of relatedness, because human beings don't exist as isolated entities but are part of each other, we need to be part of a positive community to be anything like happy and fulfilled. We need to be supporting others and supported by others. In the UK, the society I'm most familiar with, the map our society has been following for the last few hundred years has dissolved most of the bonds that bind people together, leaving just isolated nuclear families and individuals in this sea of consumerism. No wonder there's so much unhappiness and so much depression. And other societies are following in our wake, very misguidedly, using the same map. So even if we can't transform society, the best thing we can do for ourselves, for our fellow humans, and for our environment is to create positive communities based on the principles of simplicity and relatedness. And throwing ourselves into that project, at the same time as cultivating wisdom, contentment and metta in ourselves, is the best map we are going to find for ourselves for living a life that's happy and fulfilled, for ending up in paradise rather than Grindthorpe.